The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So as a couple of you know, I was just teaching a retreat last week. And the topic that we kind of ended with at the end of the retreat, reflecting on impermanence and in particular, how that seems to be very evident right now, you know, in our daily lives, not only in our meditation, but and how that can be a support for us in our practice, this reflection on impermanence. And so that's the topic that I thought to reflect on this morning. And the Buddha encouraged us the words he used were cultivate the perception of impermanence. And this theme of recognizing the impermanent nature of experience is everywhere in the suttas. Encouragement to notice the arising and passing away of experience. In the Satipatthana Sutta, it comes up over and over again. In the Buddha's instructions about mindfulness, he encouraged us to not only know what's happening, but recognize that it's arising and passing. And not just arising and passing randomly, but arising and passing in relationship to conditions. And so the cultivating this perception of impermanence is something that we can do in our meditation practice, and in a way, the guided meditation that I offered was pointing to that just a little bit. You know, that opening to moment after moment, the experience, the kind of guided meditation I offered was more of an open awareness practice than a focused practice. And in that more open awareness practice, we notice that our attention shifts. At the very least, we notice that our attention shifts from experience to experience. And then perhaps we also might begin to notice that even within an experience, sound, for instance, comes and goes, or the experience of a pressure arises, gets stronger, and then changes, shifts. A breath comes in and out, the pressure of the breath rises, strengthens, fills the lungs, and then there's a release of that pressure. So every experience has its arc, has its arising, persisting, and passing away. And then our attention also will shift. It's not necessarily that the breath, for instance, has fully completed, that the breath has passed away, but our attention perhaps has started with the breath on an in-breath and then shifts to the sound, even as the breath continues. And so there's also this shifting of attention that we can be aware of. And so we can cultivate this perception of impermanence in our meditation practice at times. And the Buddha points to the kind of the depth of the impermanence that can be revealed moment to moment. It's kind of mind-blowing at times when we really start to look at our experience in depth, just how little stability there is in what's happening in our minds and bodies. There's nothing that lasts for more than a split second. It just comes, it stays for a moment, it goes away. There's a little bit of a sense or a perception that things might linger, but within that lingering, there's a continual shifting and changing. So the Buddha points to the cultivation of this perception of impermanence mostly because, as he says, he's interested in helping us to understand suffering. Let me see what the chat says. Okay, just a comment. The perception of impermanence helps us to see that the part of the reason the suffering is coming up for us is that we're clinging to wanting things to be permanent. We're clinging to things thinking that they should be permanent. This happens at so many different levels in our experience. So the Buddha pointed to the understanding of impermanence partly to help us to see how we suffer. His whole teaching is oriented in that way, to helping us to understand how we suffer. And so the meditative level helps to see that we cling to, you know, even a moment of experience, of a fleeting, pleasant experience, the way we want a meditation to be the way it was 2 or 3 days ago, or you know, just some experience that comes up for a few moments and is unpleasant, how we want it to not be there. And so the relationship that we have to experience is revealed to us in our meditation practice, and we can see that moment to moment. And yet what I'm really interested in exploring right now isn't so much in the meditative side of experience, but more the possibility of deep understanding that can be supported by exploring impermanence at the ordinary level, reflecting on impermanence at the ordinary level, at the daily level. And I think we have a real opportunity for this right now because of the conditions of the world. I mean, I was just having a conversation with a couple of people yesterday and talking about a meeting that we're going to be having, and you know, just reflecting on where this meeting had generated. Was it a meeting, an in-person meeting a couple months ago? And you know, just thinking about that, it seems so long ago that we could meet face to face. It feels ages ago. And so life has really changed. You know, things are so different. And we are really confronted with this truth of impermanence in a very direct way. We are, I think, in a position right now to really take in the truth of impermanence in a different way than we habitually do. The Buddha says that we often misperceive around the truth of impermanence, that we perceive things to be stable, we perceive things to be permanent. Now, I don't think we really... I actually came up with this word, you know, stable this morning, and it lands a little better for me in some ways in terms of talking about this truth the misperception around the truth of impermanence. Because we often don't think of things as being permanent forever. You know, it's like the misperception, the Buddha says, we tend to take what is impermanent to be permanent. But we don't tend to usually take what is impermanent, you know, our family, you know, the way our children grow, or, you know, our homes, the way things change, things break. And I mean, we know that things are not permanent, lasting forever. But there's a way in which we attribute some kind of stability to experience. And so I found that word to be a little more resonant for myself this morning, that the kind of a belief in the stability, or that things should be stable, you know, that there should be some way in which we can or construct a situation that's going to be pretty stable so that we can live our lives in a comfortable way. Some sense of control, of ability to make things be a certain way, you know, that kind of we like stability, you know, and our system tends to like things to be regular and stable. And so when things are not stable, when this truth of impermanence is more up, our misperception, the taking things to be stable, given that misperception, we tend to have a reaction when things are unstable. We There can be emotional reactions. We may experience anger or frustration or confusion or fear or longing or grief. So many different kinds of relationships to this instability that another piece of the relationship to impermanence or the believing somehow it should be stable is that we think it must be somebody's fault if it's not stable. So there may be a kind of a self-blaming, you know, that I must have done something wrong, a shame or a blame. Can self-blaming, a self-judgment might come up around, I did something wrong, you know, what did I do wrong? Or we might blame somebody near us, somebody we're close to. We might blame them. You know, there's conversation last week, somebody talked about getting angry at a partner around a situation, you know, in going shopping. You know, it's just like it's more difficult to go shopping, and the person reported that they were really frustrated and angry with their partner, and it's like, okay, there's a blaming there. There's a, you know, it's like that person has done something, you know, it's their relationship, that person's relationship to this experience of shopping that's the problem. It's not the experience of shopping that's the problem. It's that person's relationship to the experience of shopping. And then so the anger comes up. And in the conversation, you know, we explored, well, there's so many different things we could blame. You know, in this case, the person blamed, you know, we might blame ourselves. Oh, I shouldn't have gone to this store, or, you know, so we might blame ourselves. We might blame a person close to us, or we might blame something larger. We might blame, like, the politicians for not doing the testing, and this is why it's so hard. And, you know, so there's all different reasons why, but it all comes back to this attribution of things shouldn't be this way, or things... you know, the sense of it should be the way I want it to be. So the instability, we can end up with a lot of reactivity when things don't go the way we would like them to go. And I do want to say, in thinking about, you know, whose fault it is, you know, we tend to want to blame somebody, right? We tend to want to look at that. And there's something that can be useful in that. Not the blame itself, but in looking at what the conditions are. Because as I mentioned earlier, you know, the things are impermanent, not randomly, but lawfully. They are impermanent independence on conditions. And so some of the conditions at play in the impermanent nature of experience have to do with our own choices, the choices of others, in bringing it right directly to our situation right now. It's like this situation arose because of, you know, one of the conditions at least was the market in China, and the virus that spread from animals in that market. So that's one condition. And yet, you know, so the Chinese government, you know, explored conditions to confine the outbreak, which they did a pretty good job of, looking at the wider context. And yet, you know, in various other countries, it hasn't been contained, and so the conditions unfolded for it to spread further. In our own country, you know, very different circumstances of the spread of the virus, depending on conditions and choices of political leaders around the country. And so there's choice after choice after choice after choice that has led to the situation that we're in. And we can't really pin it down to a single event. We can't say, this is why this happened. It's embedded in a vast network. What's happening right now, the arising of the conditions of this moment, are embedded in such a vast network of conditions that we can't really say this is what is to blame. And yet it can be useful to look at what our own choices are, how we respond in this moment, because it does, you know, in terms of our own suffering and our own freedom, the choices, when we make choices that are out of wisdom and compassion and kindness, when we make choices out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, we tend to find our way to more freedom, more ease, more happiness. And when choices are made, whether ours or others, make choices out of greed, aversion, and confusion, that tends to perpetuate struggle, stress, and suffering. And then there's a whole bunch of other conditions that come into play that are, you know, not necessarily, I mean, it's so, you know, the conditions that unfold in our lives, you know, things may happen to us that are really unpleasant, that are not the result, or not directly, you know, the result of an unskillful choice in that moment. So, you know, just as an example, you know, random neutral choices can radically change the unfolding of our lives. And in many cases, this is what I think in some ways what this virus is. It's like many kind of neutral choices that people made that they have been making for many years of, you know, what kind of foods we eat and where we get that food, all of this led to this outbreak. So neutral choices that we make, such as, you know, for instance, do I turn left or right at this corner? Oh, well, and you know, the conditions there might be looking at what are the immediate context of this situation. Looks like there's a lot of traffic on the left, so I'll turn right. So there's you know, it's not necessarily aversion to the traffic, but it's just a kind of natural unfolding. It's like, okay, I'm going to turn right here. And that choice may lead to getting in an accident. You know, it's like that somebody's coming fast in the other direction and runs into you. So it's like the choices, the unfolding of causes and conditions, it's like even making all of our choices out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion doesn't mean that we're not going to experience unpleasant situations. Doesn't mean that we're not going to experience impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable experience. This is the nature of experience. And yet it is useful, I think, to reflect on what our choices are and how we make them, and to support others in making skillful choices. And so I think that's part of the blame game that our mind kind of gets hooked in. That it's, you know, it is connected to something that can be useful to reflect on, did I make a skillful choice? Did that choice lead to suffering? Did that choice lead to ease? Where did that choice come from? And so the reflection on choices, are they skillful? Are they not skillful? Are they helpful? Are they helping to ease suffering? That's a useful reflection, but not through the lens of who's to blame, more through the lens of can we, in this moment, responding to these conditions, have a skillful response? So The piece that I wanted to kind of reflect on a little bit, and I'll just take another, say, 10 minutes for this, is using this reflection on impermanence. In our meditation practice, we explore impermanence more directly, you know, looking at experience, actual experience, changing nature of experience. In our daily lives, we can do that to some extent, but more often it comes in through the avenue of reflection. That we, you know, we're going through our day and we notice, we don't often notice quite so directly things are impermanent, although perhaps now we are more aware of the truth of impermanence, kind of in the way that I talked about before, you know, just like the recollection of this is how it was a month ago, this is how it is now, wow, this is different. And so it's not just the direct experience of seeing things moment to moment changing, but the reflective capacity of our mind to know this is different now than it was a month ago. And so using reflection to support our connection with the truth of impermanence. And the Buddha actually encouraged us to do this. He offered 5 subjects for frequent recollection. He said we should reflect frequently. I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. And he's encouraging us to actually bring these thoughts into our mind. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. All that I have, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And of these 5 subjects for frequent recollection, 4 are directly connected to impermanent, noticing the impermanent nature of experience. And the 5th is connected to what I was just speaking about a moment ago, the choices that we make. The 5th one is, I am the owner of my actions. Whatever actions I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So that's a kind of a reflection on the choices that we make. The actions arise based on intention, choice. And so that's a pointing to this, the truth of when we tend to act out of greed, aversion, delusion, it tends to create the conditions for struggle, stress, suffering. When we act out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, it tends to create the conditions for more ease and happiness, although not necessarily less unpleasant, just more ease with that experience, whatever experience is arising. And so in suggesting this reflection, my understanding about how reflective practice works is that we bring the thoughts into mind. And we don't just bring them into our mind and just drop them there and leave them there and go on with our day. A true reflective practice allows the thought to come into our mind, and then we check out with mindfulness, and so this is an awareness practice. It's a mindfulness exploration. I am of the nature to age. Well, let's use I'm of the nature to die. This is actually, at least for me, way more tangible now than it was even a month ago. I mean, I do quite a bit of reflection on dying, and yet there's still, you know, the mind in this reflection. It's like, oh yes, I am of the nature to die, but it's not like, you know, I'm not going to die today, you know. You know, maybe, I've probably got 25, 30 years left, you know. So the mind, you know, knows it's going to die. The system knows this is true, but it's like, again, it's the imputation of some kind of stability. You know, the sense that, yeah, this is going to last a while, and actually we don't really know. And so this, this to me has become way more obvious right now. You know, I am, you know, over 60, and I have some underlying health conditions, and so every time I go out for a grocery shop, it's a great reflection on I am of the nature to die. This, the virus might find me in the grocery store, and who knows, you know, what the results of that would be. You know, so to reflect on this, to bring that thought into mind, I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. And really hold that in the mind, you know, with some kind of, you know, sometimes it could be held in the mind even with an image, you know, a kind of a sense of what it might be for this being to die. How might that happen? And right now that's a little bit easier for me to envision a scenario of, you know, being in the hospital and being attached to a ventilator and struggling to breathe. And, you know, so all of that, bringing that into the mind. And then, how does it land? How does the system respond to that? So this is looking at our relationship to these truths. We're not trying to have the perfect relationship with these reflections. We're trying to uncover the relationships that are already here. So that those when we bring these thoughts into our mind, it's kind of like metta practice. We can use these reflections very much the way we might use metta practice, bringing a reflection into mind. May you be happy. May I be healthy. May I be safe. And so bringing those thoughts into mind with the metta practice, then we check in. How does that land? What is our relationship to that? May you be happy, you know, wishing that for a dear friend, and then feeling a little bit of envy at their happiness. So that the practice of metta, this reflecting on bringing thoughts into mind of well-wishing, reveals or uncovers kind of clinging or, you know, a holding or reaction in relationship to those wishes. And so the same can be true of these reflections on impermanence. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. How does that land? Is the mind kind of resistant to it, numb to it, fearful of it, confused by it? What is the relationship? And then seeing if the mindfulness can hold that. Again, not trying to have equanimity about it, but can there be some balance of mind around that response? Oh, there's fear. Okay, can I hold that fear? It's natural for there to be fear around this truth of death. It's natural. And so it's conditioned also. You know, we've learned in a way to have this relationship to death. And the other part of it is just the idea of non-existence. You know, some of it is the unknown of that we are fearful of that. The sense of what happens after we die, we don't know. And some of it, maybe for some of us, it's, for me, I've discovered it's not actually the fear of non-existence. It's not the fear of not being here. For me, it's more the fear of going through pain on the way to death. So for me, that's the place of stickiness. That's the place to see, oh, okay, yeah, if I'm struggling to breathe, if it feels like I'm drowning, can the mind acknowledge and know, yes, this may be the way this being dies? Sometimes I found in this reflection, so right now I'm just kind of taking you through my own process around one reflection, something that I found, it's an odd kind of comfort, but I've recognized through this reflection, because this reflection also opens us to the wider world. We see in this reflection, I am of the nature to die, I have not gone beyond dying. This is not just true of this being. It's not like personal that I'm going to die. This is just the nature of being alive, that I'm going to die. And as I kind of, as it expands my mind to include all of humanity, you know, all of human, every being that has died before now, and there have been millions of them, millions of beings that have died. Human beings have gone through this process. That is somehow very settling for me, that this is a process that humans have experienced. And probably any way I can fathom dying. Plane crash is a big one for me. Beings have died in plane crashes. They have experienced that whole process. So for me, that sense of fear around going down and knowing that I'm going to hit the ground, that whole process in the mind around the reactivity there, when I remember this has happened to beings before, I don't know exactly why, but it is comforting. You know, it has a way to help me, I guess, maybe not feel alone in it or not feel separate somehow, like it's just something that's happening to me. So it broadens the mind and allows the other piece that I wanted to bring in here is that this reflection in my own experience has really opened me to compassion when the heart kind of lets go of its reactivity around the impermanence, and in this case, the reflection on dying. When it lets go of that, it opens to compassion. Not only for ourselves, but for other beings who also will go through this and also have fear about this, also have confusion, also have grief and longing. And so this reflection on impermanence and the universal nature of this, the wisdom around the truth of impermanence, it's not just equanimity that comes with this. That's a beautiful response to the contemplation of impermanence, is that the mind does become balanced around it. But through that balance, it also opens to connection to all beings, connection to this is true for all beings, and the kind of heartbreak of the way people suffer around this truth. For me, this has been such an opening to compassion in reflecting on these truths of impermanence. And so, you know, the reflection practice is simple, just bringing the thought to mind. And with the reflections on impermanence, you could use it in the frame of I am of the nature to die, but also maybe taking it in the way that we do for the metta practice, starting with yourself, then reminding yourself that, you know, your friends, your family, you know, your children, your parents, all of the nature to die. Neutral people of the nature to die. For me, that was a real doorway for the compassion, easier to feel ease with the truth of impermanence for neutral people, but just to recognize and know that, yeah, they too will be going through all of this stuff that I'm going through around these reflections, around this truth. And difficult people, all beings, you know, difficult people, you know, looking at the relationship there, you know, it's like, yeah, they deserve it. Okay, wow, that's an interesting response that we might have. So, you know, to look at our responses to this. And then even perhaps to enlarge the reflection to not only beings are of the nature to die or have this impermanent nature, but systems, political systems are of this nature, and global systems are of this nature. You know, the planet is destined to be burned up by the sun at some point. So just, you know, we can even think about this in a much larger scale. And also for me, that kind of helps helps me to hold the personal with a little more ease that things are so impermanent on the larger scale, as the Buddha talked about. He said, eons of world expansion and world contractions. That this is the nature of the universe, of the processes that go in our lives. And so I think right now we have a real opportunity, because impermanence is so obvious right now. Rather than kind of resisting it or fighting it, you know, in some ways we can look at it as an opportunity or a gift. This truth of impermanence is kind of helping us to let go of the misperception around stability, you know, misperceiving things to be stable. And so rather than fighting it or just kind of like waiting, when is it going to get back to normal? Well, you know, what is normal? Using it as an opportunity to open to this reflection. What is this relationship to impermanence? How am I with this? And opening to that with mindfulness. Opening to what the relationship is, not to have a perfect relationship, but to reveal where the holding is. Because all of those holdings, all of those clingings, are ways in which we tend to suffer. We tend to experience struggle and stress out of those patterns and habits of resistance to impermanence. And so as those are revealed to us, we have much more of an opportunity not to have them be kind of functioning in the back of our minds, you know, just making our choices, driving our reactivity, but that with the opportunity for them to be seen, there's the possibility that we can hold that with some balance. See the impermanent nature of that response and the dukkha nature of that response, the unhelpful nature of that response. And that supports the growth of wisdom. That supports our mind to begin to relate to things in a new way. Not that we just pick up a skillful relationship, but that maybe we can see there's another way to hold this relationship that's a kind of a model. And so, okay, I can know that there's fear around pain in death. Oh, I can know that, and I can be at ease with knowing that fear. That supports the mind to move in the direction of letting go of that fear. Not on our time frame, not by our saying, yes, that I go away fear. I can just choose to make you go away. But more in the way of learning, that as we learn what the experience of fear is, our system begins to kind of reorient, respond differently to that experience, and learns to let go of it.